Are you ready, Alabama?
Oh, the band is out on the field!
The band is leaving the field.
And one time, at band camp,
loved the drum.
Man, I do love my drum.
If you say that's what she said one more time, I'm gonna pop you.
You're welcome to join the doghouse.
Oh God, I'm so sorry. I keep doing that.
Call the big dog now at 866-485-9867.
Be a dog.
The clock starts on my whistle.
How you doing?
It's time for the second half of the Tom Abraham Show. Here he is, the head of the household. Here's drum major Big Dog. It's Tom Abraham.
We strong.
You all may be taking the week off, this week, but I'm not.
Welcome in, second half of the show. By the way, let's just clean up some business there. Dave the Dog Beaner scores the tickets to Sunday's Braves-Mets game. The question was, who is second on the single-season home run list for the Atlanta Braves? And believe it or not, Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews tied at 47 home runs. You would think that Hank Aaron had the all-time record for a single season. It was Andrew Jones in 2005, hit 51 home runs. Aaron had 47 in 19 and 71. Eddie Matthews had 47 in 1953. He also had 46 in 59. Hank Aaron is all over this list. Chipper Jones had 45, tied for fifth with Hank Aaron. That was Chipper in 19 and 99. And then Hank Aaron is tied for seventh with himself, basically, all the way down through Dale Murphy, who also had 44. Hank Aaron had 44 four times in that deal. So Hank Aaron and Eddie Matthews. So Dave the Dog Beaner is the winner of the tickets, and he's got to come on down. He'll come on down to the radio station and pick those up either before 6 o'clock tonight or tomorrow all day long, and he's going to see the Mets and the Braves. It's going to be a beautiful, beautiful weather in Atlanta this weekend, and he can check that out. All right, Matt Scalise joins us now from AL.com. Matt, welcome in. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Fantastic. You know, I have seen a lot of different kind of commitments, but the video that you guys did for Alan Love's commitment to Ole Miss is pretty cool. Take us behind the curtain with that deal there. Have we had a hype video like that for a commitment before, and how did that get originated, okay, we're going to do this?
Yeah, we've been doing those for a couple of years now, and typically we've really done them for special occasions around signing day. It's a pretty big undertaking. It takes a multi-band crew. It takes a few days to edit it. You know, it's obviously probably the most difficult part of it is coordinating with the actual recruits, because that's a big announcement for them, and that's a big moment in their lives. You're convincing them that, hey, you know, this is something we want to be a part of with you, and we can help make it more special for you. So, you know, we did it a couple of years ago, I think once or twice, and then really I think that the biggest successes we had were we did announcement videos like this for Mack Wilson and Ben Davis, who happened to be the two biggest players in the state in their recruiting class about a year ago. And really, once we did those two, a lot of other recruits around the state saw it and noticed it, and they've really been reaching out to us ever since, kind of asking us to do these with them. So that was kind of the best advertising we could have gotten for it, was to have the two best players in the state shoot those videos with us. You're going to see a lot more of them going forward. We have some things lined up with a lot of players. We did it last year also, by the way, with Henry Ruggs III. Who was one of the top players in the state in this last signing class. So it's become a more regular thing for us.
Nah, it was really well done, and it's very cool. The only thing is the kid is kind of committed to his commitment then at that point in time, right? You got to make sure, you can't say, look, don't rush this. just because you want this hype video done at AL.com. He's a three-star defensive tackle out of Huffman High there in Birmingham. But you've got to – I would imagine that you want to do a little bit of due diligence. You don't want him to do a one of these guys that's flipping his commitment all the time.
I can't speak to the depth of his commitment, and I'll tell you this. I've covered recruiting long enough to know that only a fool says that a recruitment is over before signing day. That is never the case, and there's always a chance something weird could happen. But I think on the part of these recruits, when they want to make a large public show of their commitment, I think for the most part they've thought it through, they've gone through all their options, and they've pretty much made their decision. That's not to say that it's ironclad, because nothing in recruiting ever is. But Alan Love, I know, had a really good rapport with our camera crew that went and shot that with him. He's a very smart kid and a good kid, and I think he's probably done with his recruiting process. And I also think that he's an underrated guy that you'll continue to see his rankings with recruiting services go up as they see more film of him, particularly during his senior season.
We talked, shift gears a little bit, Matt Scalise with AL.com. Yesterday, when news broke that Bob Stoops was retiring effective immediately from Oklahoma, we reached out to James Hale, and we talked to him out at Oklahoma. He told us about, a potential medical report that said that Stoops needs to kind of reduce stress. We knew about his dad had died at a relatively young age, coaching and so on. And he took everything at face value. Today we talked to Sean Adams from Austin, Texas, and his take was a little bit different. He thinks something's up. He thinks this is very fishy, that there was some pushing going on, and we're afraid of losing Lincoln Riley. Where does Matt Scalise land on this thing? Does this Stoops thing seem, you taking it for face value, or is there something going on there?
My first thought when the news came out was definitely something must be up. This can't be right. And more than anything else, it's the timing of it. We have obviously seen coaches retire sooner than expected. We've seen guys leave their jobs and decide to go do something else. But it doesn't make any sense for Bob Stoops to make this announcement and do this in June. That doesn't line up with logic. And I think my first thought was, is it some kind of scandal or some kind of health issue? And, look, whatever it ends up being, I think the fact that the sort of general reaction to it has been this sort of unanimous praise and lionized this guy as this sort of, paragon of great coaching for his generation, I have a bit of a problem with that. I don't love that. I think we've glossed over a lot of things about Bob Stoops in the last 24 hours, whether it's the way he handled the Joe Mixon situation or Doriel Green Beckham. This guy was not perfect, and I know no coaches are, but I think on top of it, even if there's nothing else going on and he just decided to make this move in June, my first question is, what about all the recruits that just finished enrolling in school and got to campus, and now they hear that they're not going to be playing for the coach that they signed with? I didn't hear anybody bring that up on the Oklahoma beat. I didn't hear any of the people praising Bob Stoops for doing it the right way bring up how this affects all the 25 kids, arguably the best recruiting class Oklahoma has ever signed, how it affects those guys who now go from having a national championship caliber head coach to playing for a 33-year-old head coach that frankly hadn't done a lot to prove himself, hadn't done anything to prove himself as a head coach. I think there's been a lot of one-sided coverage, I think, in the last 24 hours of this. I'm glad to hear that you and other guys like you are talking to people who are asking more questions about this.
Yeah, and, there's been some rumor about a potential investigation coming and things like that. And, you can't attribute it to anything that's legit, so you don't really, roll with that. And my first, when I hear of a guy who's 56 years old, I'm 56 years old, right? So when I hear of this, I'm thinking to myself, this guy is relatively young, you know, to be doing this at this point in time. Of course, we've seen others, Urban Meyer and so on, go through what they went through, and who knows what the health aspect. I immediately figured that there has to be a health concern. He immediately poo-pooed that yesterday, Bob Stoops himself. But this concept of, you know, we can't take a chance on losing Lincoln Riley is an interesting one, you know? I mean, I know he was highly sought after. You wonder whether or not Stoops just kind of got fed up with it to the point where he said, you know, all right, go ahead, take him, you got him.
You know, I can't imagine that the important people at Oklahoma would allow that to happen. I realize that securing the future of your program is important, and you want to have, you know, keep great assistants in place. But let's not forget who we're talking about here. This is a guy that's unquestionably one of the top five head coaches in college football right now. He's one of the, you know, one of the highest paid for a reason. He's won a tremendous amount of games in the last 18 years at Oklahoma. He's been very consistent. I know a lot of people get frustrated with him not being able to close the deal, but we're talking about the Big 12 right now, talking about Oklahoma. This is a school that's in an area where there's not a lot of talent. He's managed to bring in elite talent to Oklahoma. While you look at schools around him, like Nebraska, that frankly, they have a really hard time signing any blue-chip prospect. Oklahoma has managed to stay on par with the top programs around the country, despite a lot of the disadvantages they face being in the Big 12 and being where they are geographically. And again, Lincoln Riley, you can talk about all the promise you want out of Lincoln Riley. He's 33 years old. This guy has no experience running a program of this caliber on his own. There's a lot of lessons he's going to have to learn, probably the hard way. We'll see how this season goes. But I don't think Oklahoma, that anybody in their right mind at Oklahoma would have pushed Bob Stoops out the door just to make sure that they keep Lincoln Riley. I think there has to be something else going on, whether it's infighting over a specific issue or something off the field that we don't know about yet, haven't heard about. I think something still just doesn't smell right about this to me.
Yeah, Matt Scalise with us from AL.com. All right, we've been talking the last couple of weeks about, you know, how much coverage that you guys may give to this Nashville Predator run, which is kind of taking the South by storm now, and the viewership and the interest is off the charts. But I gotta say, seeing Nick Saban in a Preds jersey, I mean, that's it. That makes him the number one Predneck, you know, in the region. I mean, that's crazy. And I guess he was at Game 3. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, he went to the game, wore a jersey to the game, so he's apparently into it. And he was actually asked about it today. At a small media gathering he had, just that he's been getting into it and been wearing his Predators jersey around the house. And so he's apparently full-on into this team. And it's funny to see and hear that, because we just so rarely hear Nick Saban talk about watching sports and enjoying sports as a fan. It's kind of funny to see him play that role.
And apparently he's good buddies with Joe Girardi, and he rocks a Yankee jersey every once in a while. I just never thought of Saban as a jersey rocking guy. You know what I mean? I never thought. And we saw all of the stars, and they keep showing the country music stars and the different people that have been at the game and everything else. And, you know, does Nick Saban, does he blend? I mean, does he have Miss Terry? Did he just blend into the crowd? Because she's waving towels. She's totally into it, according to him.
I would have to guess he was in somebody's box at Bridgestone Arena. I don't think he was sitting out among the rabble at that game. But yeah, it's, you know, I could see it. You know, he's from West Virginia. I don't know if they play a lot of hockey up there, but it certainly gets cold enough ponds to freeze over in West Virginia. So maybe Nick Saban has grown up a secret hockey fan all this time. I don't know.
Well, he says that where he's from, they're all Penguin fans. So that northern part of West Virginia,
makes sense.
Yeah, you know, that's bordering Pennsylvania, and he says that he's been getting a lot of crap from a lot of folks back home that's all Penguin country back there.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's a southerner now. He's been there too long, but yeah, I do think that has sort of solidified our coverage at AL.com of this NHL run. But, you know, we actually have had some interest from our readers in the northern part of the state. I don't think it's the same everywhere. I think you still have a lot of folks in Birmingham and South Alabama that just kind of tune out. But I think that we've seen pretty solid proof that in northern Alabama, it's legitimate hockey country at this point.
Yeah, big time TV ratings, of course, up into 10. Well, the numbers are big all over the country, really, for the most part. And it's funny because I've been a frequent guest now on Bobby Hebert's show in New Orleans, on WWL down in New Orleans with Bobby Hebert and Deke Bellavea. And I've been their kind of their hockey correspondent, and they're talking about down in New Orleans how people are talking about it, and that's crazy. You know what I mean? Because you wouldn't think them crazy Cajuns down there, man. They wouldn't want anything to do with it.
It's been as somebody who does not watch hockey outside of the Stanley Cup and the Olympics, it's been an enormously entertaining series to watch, and it's fun to see. To me, just to see the crowd get so rowdy and so into it. There's obviously a ton of energy there, and I think anybody who's bothered to tune in to any of the Stanley Cup Finals, there have been some great characters that have emerged and some names, and I do wonder what the lasting effect of it will be for the NHL's national reputation, which obviously has suffered in the last decade or so. But I think this has to be a pretty big year for them, and I don't know if it's just the South or if it's this way the rest of the country, but I do think, you know, it's a good thing that a lot of people are talking about the Stanley Cup right now. In the middle of the NBA Finals going on, a very lackluster NBA Finals that are kind of hard to watch. So it's a good time to be into hockey, I guess, right now.
Yeah, there's no question. And from everybody I talk to on a national level, they say that there's three things that are at work here. One is Nashville's star power, you know, and the fact that the noise that is being made there. And what I try to tell people as much as possible is, because they can't understand, you know, the way the crowd is and everything else. Like, you got to understand, it is SEC country. That is an SEC football crowd. That's what they're doing.
Yeah,
it's an SEC. And then you add this to it. You know, what was Nashville the hub of for years and years and years back in the day? Professional wrestling. And that's the other thing that there's a, you know, with the catfish, I mean, that's a professional wrestling / superstar country music / SEC football crowd. And then the other thing is what you mentioned, the lackluster NBA final and NBA playoff, which has been boring. There's nothing competitive going on there. And then the third aspect of it is people who know hockey know that you're either a Penguins fan or you hate the Penguins, because people don't like Sidney Crosby. They think he's a punk and this and that, and the Penguins are one of these polarizing teams. So it's like the rest of the country is rallying behind that team from the South to beat the hated Penguins. Only the people in Pittsburgh and West Virginia and that part of Ohio, you know, really like the Penguins. If you're not a Penguins fan, you're an everybody else fan. So I think all of those things just came together to create this.
Yeah, Nashville has been, I guess, a pro sports market now for, you know, I guess we're close to 20 years or so, maybe a little bit more than that. And, you know, they've had some moments to prove themselves. I think what's fun to see is that the NHL, especially in the South, still has a little bit of an appeal of being this sort of niche thing that just you and your buddies are into. It's not quite as corporatized as the NFL. Mm-hmm. And I realize there's a lot of NFL fans all over the country. It's the most popular sport in the country for a reason. But for people like me that grew up on college sports, and I think probably a lot of people in the Nashville market are the same way, there's something that's not intimate about the NFL. There's something that sucks the energy out of the building. I think that hockey has that. I think it injects that energy and that sort of the camaraderie that a smaller knit fan base, like a college sports fan base, sometimes gets with each other. When you mention that SEC fan base aspect of it, it just really rings true, and it sounds like it when you're there. You know, I think it's a club that it's fun to be a part of, even though you know that it may not be the biggest club in town, but that kind of makes you love it a little bit more.
Yeah, and the numbers in Tennessee have been the ratings for the last game were higher than any Titans game. They were higher than a national championship game, way higher than any Vols game. The only thing higher was the Super Bowl. I mean, in terms of sheer bodies, over 350,000 people watching the game on TV. And, of course, there was another 17,000 at the game and another 50,000 in the streets outside, so they don't get counted. None of the electronic digital people watching on apps and things like that get counted. So it's everybody's just amazed by it. I mean, it's crazy. More people than watched any Titans game all year long on CBS at prime Sunday afternoon in the fall. You know, that's blown it away. So it's kind of nuts.
Nashville's a great city for that street atmosphere too. You know, it's just built perfectly for that sort of street festival atmosphere that you see so much on Twitter and on TV of these fans just camping out in the street, bringing their folding chairs out there and watching it, you know, out in the middle of the city. I think that's probably the coolest part of it to me. Just seeing that phenomenon emerge.
Yeah, that's good stuff. All right, as always, a pleasure. Matt Scalise, Spun Our Guest, AL.com. Matt, appreciate you, man.
Thanks, Tom. See you next week.
All right, thank you. There you go, Matt Scalise. He's just so good. Very good. You know what else is really good is Eric Hazeltine. He is the voice of the Memphis Grizzlies. He also does sports talk radio in Memphis. And I guarantee you we'll have some strong takes on the NBA and the NBA final. But we'll do that next right here at 7:30, 103.9, the Ump.
If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I don't want to go. If heaven ain't a lot like Dixie, I just as soon stay home.
So why are you playing old Hank Williams music? Well, because it's Throwback Thursday. Hank Williams is coming back to Monday Night Football, so we selected him. Throwback Thursday. I haven't listened to a lot of Hank in a long time, but you know, there's a little bit of Hank there for you. If you're ready for some football, you'll have that guy. If you're ready for some basketball, well, you're the one, right? I mean, it just has not been a real – well, I take that back. The ratings for games one and two were the highest TV ratings in the post-Jordan era. Probably pretty high last night as well. I don't know that they're going to be very high on Friday night. I'm not sure. But the voice – of the Memphis Grizzlies and a radio talk show host in his own right in Memphis. And a guy that you hear on this show, he doesn't know it, but he's a guy that you hear almost every day with this cut.
Should be a friggin' investigation.
That is Eric Hazeltine, and he joins us now on the Woody Anderson Ford VIP hotline. Eric, welcome in. How are you, man?
Great, big dog. How are you?
I'm fantastic. You didn't know that you gave me material.
Should be a friggin' investigation.
That's one of my favorite cuts, man.
yeah, I might have been a little upset during that game or something along those times. But, yeah, I'm glad I gave you some good material there.
Please, you did give me good material. Yeah, and look, you know, I know my listeners, unless they listen a lot from back in the day, may not know that you are from the Oakland area and grew up as a Golden State fan, and your dad's you know, a Golden State season ticket holder, and you kind of have gone down that path as well. But I got to tell you, we played the cut earlier for Kevin Durant's dagger. I mean, just a flat out dagger that he dropped on the Cavs in that deal, and it was from the Golden State radio team. And I, you know, as a connoisseur of the craft, I don't know the guy. Kind of thin on the voice, though. I mean, I was not very impressed for being a Golden State Warriors, man. I'm just saying.
He's a good friend, so I haven't heard Tim's call, but Tim's pretty good. But I think I talked to him about this because I told him flat out, I said, dude, if I called your team's games, I'd go nuts. I'd have a heart attack. Right. You know me. I get diehard into our team's games, and I want them to go 82-0, and I think the only team that could even fathom doing that would be Golden State. So I haven't heard it, but Tim's a low key guy. But so I don't know what happened, but I wondered what it sounded like. So it's always funny when you're in a final situation or a situation like that. We actually had it where I forgot who we were playing. It was Russell Westbrook, and he was going for a triple double type record. And we basically got a note before the game, you know, earlier in the day, and they said, hey, listen, just don't over-embellish it, don't under-embellish it, but realize your calls, like they said it to Pete Pranica, our TV voice, and myself, your calls could very well be used in a lot of highlights in a lot of places. So, one, don't, you know, blanket up, and two, don't try to downplay it either or be too snarky about it. So, I don't know, maybe Tim didn't quite know what to say at that moment, because when he hit that shot, I was like, he did not just pull a 27-foot three to take the lead with 45 seconds and make it. That's ridiculous.
Korver for three. He missed it. Durant's got the rebound. 50 seconds to go for the Warriors. They're down by two. Durant at the left side calls his own number down, and he hit a three. Durant hit a three. The Warriors lead by one. 114-113 with 42 seconds to go.
I don't know. I mean, it's your buddy.
Subdued.
You know what I mean? A little thin, a little subdued. I'm just saying, voice talent wise, he's, you know, I'm used to hearing Eric Hazeltine. I mean, I love, you know, you got a little rasp that you bring to it, and we have a bunch of broadcasters that come on. Just a little thin. But you're right with those cuts, because I've talked to Eli Gold many times about this. Anytime you watch anything documentary wise about the death of Dale Earnhardt, it's not the TV call, really, that you see. It's not the Fox. It was the first race ever for Fox. It's not the Fox call. You hear Eli Gold's radio call of Dale Earnhardt hitting the wall, and it lives on in all of the documentaries and everything else. So, you know, you never know when you're going to do something like that, and then the next thing you know, some idiot is playing.
Should be a friggin' investigation.
You know, all the time. You don't know.
Well, I'll tell you this much. Here's how I know. You never know who's listening. And for Tim, side note about Tim Roy, he was actually one of my mentors. I worked under Tim in Sacramento at a station that's produced four of the NBA's, you know, 60 announcers, basically, came from one little spot in Sacramento, and a fifth one will come from there as well when a guy takes over in Sacramento for the play-by-play for the Kings. But I was on a flight to China. I was heading over to Thailand for some family, to help a family friend out moving back to the States. And I'm watching an NBA TV thing, and I'll be shocked if not stunned that there was one of my radio calls on an NBA TV thing going to China, and I saw like eight people watching this, and I'm like, I wonder if any of them realized that highlight they heard was my call. Probably not, because they don't know who the hell I am, but it was kind of neat.
That was like the old Sam Artigliano line when he told Brian Sipe when he threw that interception against the Raiders in the 1980 playoff game. And he told him, he said, well, think of this. There's 800 million Chinese who don't even care that you threw that interception. So that might have been
how
the deal there.
How sick is this? I know the name of that play. That play was called Red Right 88.
Yeah.
And Mike Haynes picked it off as a Raiders fan. And Cleveland to this day, those fans still, if you bring up Red Right 88 in the Cleveland sports bar, some old guy will probably inevitably throw a beer at you.
But you don't have to tell me, because I'm a Browns fan. So I was on the other side of Red Right 88, and Red Right 88 resonates in my brain forever on that thing. And why he didn't throw that ball into Lake Erie, I don't know. But tried to squeeze it into Ozzie Newsome out of Alabama. So there you go. We brought it all the way back to the SEC, just like that. All right. I'm this is where I'm at. I'm full on choke job on this deal. I mean, not only do you not score in the last 3.5 minutes of the game, but LeBron James takes two shots in the last 7 minutes. His last made basket is at 6:57 to go. He jacks up two shots. He misses a layup and a 12-foot bunny and doesn't take any other shots down the stretch. And Eric, in my opinion, I don't care if he scored 60 points. If you're not even taking a shot in the last 7 minutes, something's not right. And in the meantime, Kevin Durant scored 7 points in the last minute and 15 seconds.
Well, I'll say this. I agree with you in that he's got to take more shots down the stretch, but that's always been LeBron's nature, trying to create in those situations, thinking, hey, if they double and triple team me and take away my options, someone's going to be open. I did not have a problem with the pass he made to Kyle Korver. You're talking about one of the premier three-point shooters the league has ever seen in a short corner three situation where, in rhythm, If I'm a Cavs fan or if you've ever watched Kyle Korver, I think he probably makes that in rhythm 60-70% of the time. And if he makes it, it's a dagger. It's over. It's done.
Yeah.
But the other ones where Kyrie took a bad shot, but he's trying to create. But if you're LeBron, I agree. Down the stretch, you've got to get, I think, a few more looks. And he's going to get uber defensive about that when anybody asks him. But that's just the nature of it. Now, I'm not going to say, oh, Michael wouldn't have done this, because that's now the rhetoric of everybody that's always trying to compare these two. But when you're going down the stretch, LeBron's got to get more than two shots. And I can't credit Golden State's defense 100% for doing that. I think a lot of it comes from LeBron trying to, you know, maybe make the other guys more of a threat so it becomes easier for him. The thing about Golden State, and I've known this about them since, you know, 3 years ago when they were first really breaking through, they just keep coming. They just keep coming at you. It doesn't matter what angle, where from, they just keep coming. You never have these guys in a position and out of a game where you're not still thinking, hey, they could make a run at this. The Grizzlies mm-hmm. beat them twice, and the first time rather handily in Memphis. Now, they'll tell you that Andre Iguodala and Zsa Zsa Pachulia didn't play, and I tell them, well, Durant, Green, and Thompson and Curry all did, so mm-hmm. forget that rhetoric. But that whole game, the Grizzlies were up by 10, 15 points, and I remember sitting with my partner, Hank McDowell, and looking and going, all right, when are they making their run? When are they making their run? And it wasn't until like 2-3 minutes left when they kind of waved the white flag and started pulling guys, and I went, they're not going to make their run, but you expected it. So if you're Cleveland, you had to know that was coming, and LeBron, I think, needed to take that over a little bit more. The thing that I thought he did that I would go back, and, you know, it's hard to be critical of a guy that's averaging a triple-double and is the best player in the world, but where I thought he made the biggest mistake was after that miss. You cannot let Kevin Durant walk into a 27-footer. I know it's not the most high-percentage shot, and I know a lot of people are going, boy, that's not what a coach would teach you. These guys in the NBA today, that 27-footer is almost like a 20-footer or a 15-footer to them when they have the rhythm. And when you're up by two, I would much rather see a guy driving to the basket and possibly tie the game or hope the defense collapses than just give him a straightaway walk-in, almost like a shoot-around practice-type shot to take the lead, because it changes the complexion of the game. You got to take away that three-point line, and I thought he went too deep defensively in transition.
And that's the only reason, and you're right, by the way, Korver career-wise is 60% on that corner three ball.
So I
get that on LeBron dishing that thing here. But here's my take on that. They're up by two. They're not down two. Yeah. They're up two. So right. What I'm thinking is that I don't care how many people collapse on you, you're friggin' LeBron James. Take that thing to the cup and go to the line. I really think the guy does not like going to the line late in these games. And you know, if you get hacked, you get hacked. Because of the fact that you were already up, you know, you don't need to go up by five. Going up by four is fine. You don't need a three ball there. And that's why I think he has to take it stronger. He has to take command of the game late. And he wants to get everybody involved and all that stuff. But there comes a point in time. We've seen him at other times do it. But you just saw why I might agree with Paul Pierce. I mean, Kevin Durant might be the best player out there right now. 7 points in the last minute is more important than 38 points in the first 50 minutes. You know what I mean? Or in the first 40 minutes, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Paul's got a point in terms of right now, but I still would go with LeBron. Here's the thing. You and I have discussed this over the years, Tom, and I've told you multiple times. I think the guy, if there was a 1 and then a 1A, it was LeBron and Kevin Durant. And I was a big proponent that Kevin Durant was very close to overtaking that top spot, and I got a lot of pushback. And then Kevin had some injury problems his last year in Oklahoma City, and there the year before that. And so Steph Curry kind of came into the mix, and all of a sudden the rhetoric changed just a little bit. But you're talking about a guy that's 28 years old, which is generally when you hit your peak. He's not going to turn 29 until September. He's getting better. And he, I think, is finally in a system that he doesn't have to worry about whether or not he's going to get the ball at the right time or not. And, you know, everybody that's critical of Kevin, I'm sure Kevin could put an end to that criticism by saying, hey, look, I didn't enjoy playing with Russell Westbrook as much as I'd enjoy playing with someone else. I never knew what Russ was going to show up on the floor. Is it going to be the Russ that wants to get everybody else involved, or is it going to be the Russ that when we fall behind by three tries to drive one on five when everybody else is sitting wide open and we're losing games because of it? I don't want to deal with that anymore. Or, hey, I played for a certain coach for 7 years from the time I was in Seattle to the time we moved to Oklahoma City, and you guys fire him despite the fact that we're winning basketball games and bringing a college coach that I don't know, and no offense to Billy Donovan, but maybe he doesn't like playing for Billy Donovan, so he takes off, and yet all the rhetoric is he took the easy way out. Well, hey, man, the guy gave a team 9 years. And when he looks at the fits with other teams and he says, well, I don't fit with Boston the same way I fit with Golden State, or I don't fit with Houston the same way I fit with Golden State or the Clippers or the Spurs or any of these teams, why wouldn't you go where you feel like you fit the best? And here's the thing about that team. there's an age-old saying that when I got in the broadcasting business, that I was told and said, listen, if your team gets 30 assists, you're almost guaranteed a win. And I'm like, well, that makes sense. You're sharing the basketball. You know, you're moving it. You're scoring. You're making shots. They average 30 assists. So they're supposed to win every single game by the averages. That's crazy. But what it also tells you is, despite the fact you've got a two-time MVP, another guy who's a Team USA and 20-plus point-per-game guy, and now you add in this third big-time scorer, they're sharing the basketball. They share the basketball, and they are fine with one of them scoring 45. You know, Klay Thompson had that NBA record point-scoring quarter against the Sacramento Kings, and I watched the game. I watched Steph Curry pass up a layup to give it to Klay Thompson. When asked about it after, he said, man's got the hot hand. I'm not taking that away from him. And you're going, dude, you're the MVP of the league. Most MVPs take that layup and get a little bit of theirs, and that's not the way they think. And I think that appealed a lot to Kevin. And so he's only going to get better. And I fully expect him to either stay in the deal for another year or opt out and take less money and this group to stay together. And everybody in the West is going to be chasing at their heels for a long time.
Yeah, that's what I've been told by a number of national types that say that they think he's going to stay there and they're going to stay together and try to do something historic. I mean, look, this really should be three in a row, and who knows when it stops. The flip side is, and I was watching Adam Silver last night and during the halftime in the minute and a half they gave him to kind of talk about some of these things and his feeling on it. And he says, well, you know, the rest of the league will respond, and it's incumbent on the other players to get better. And there's only so many of these kind of guys to go around. If you work for the Memphis Grizzlies or the San Antonio Spurs even, or the, you know, the Dallas Mavericks, I mean, how are you selling to your fan base that you literally have a chance to win a championship, and it's not just an exhibition deal where you go to the games, you have a good time, but you're not going to win anything? Because this looks like on both sides, I don't see who's going to threaten either of these teams for the next couple of years.
Well, I think Boston could get in on the East, and they're going to, because what's going to end up happening, they have not only the number one pick this year, they get Brooklyn's pick next year too. So that'll be the end of that fleece job that Danny Ainge pulled over on the Nets when they tried to win a title by just basically swinging for the fences in one big trade and gave up the future to do it. They could have never predicted it would go this badly, but it has. And for Boston, it's been a godsend. So they'll have the third overall pick from last year, Jaylen Brown, and they'll have this year's number one, and they may very well have next year's number one, plus some talented players. Washington will be in that mix. But yeah, the thing about the Warriors, it will be like that. But as one general manager said to anonymously, and I've heard other scouts say, what you do is you try to get the two or the three seed. You stay out of their bracket. And the thing about the NBA is you never know. You know, one wrong step and one of those guys goes down, they're still awesome, but they're not the same. They lose an aura of invincibility. And that happens to everybody. And to be honest with you, other than the 20 games this year they lost Kevin Durant, they have not dealt with the injury bug in 3 years. They have not had a significant major injury to one of their players that's kept them out half a season or three quarters of a year or an entire season. It's affected how they go. And, hey, good fortune for them because I've been on that side of it. I've been on the opposite side of it. So you got to just keep building it for what you want and realize that sometimes it's a rarity. But the stars and the numbers just happened to align in this situation where they had an awesome team. They had a couple guys up for free agency. They had a guy that had a tradable expiring contract. And, oh, by the way, the league backed a Brinks truck full of $30 million to every owner's door and said, here you go, go spend it. And the biggest mistake teams made, I thought, was feeling the need to have to spend it and overspend it. And that was where Golden State hit the home run. Well, yeah, you have to spend a certain amount when your salary cap goes up. It's called the floor level. But if you don't get to the floor level, here's what happens. Denver was $1 million below the floor level, so they made just a pointless trade for Roy Hibbert, who did nothing for them down the stretch, and they end up missing the playoffs. Well, they paid him that $1 million. It was at $1.5 million. If they would have kept that $1.5 million, you know what the other 15 guys in the locker room would have got? A $100,000 bonus because they get dispersed to the players. I would rather be the GM that tells my team, I believe in you guys. I'm going to build it with you guys. I'm not going to overpay a bad contract. If we're below the floor, you guys are going to make a little bit more money, but it's also going to give us more money down the long run. When everybody else has kind of spent their money, we're going to have more money in free agency than everyone else. It's going to take a thought like that to me to get a team to really put some pieces together, and you're going to have to draft well. You know, the Warriors didn't buy all this talent. They drafted predominantly every single one of them other than Kevin Durant, And the Andre Iguodala deal was they got Andre because they had guys that they drafted that they could trade. So they put it together, and then it just happened to coincide at the exact right time where they had a bunch of money to spend, and Kevin Durant said, hey, San Francisco seems like it would suit me. It's more mellow and relaxed than New York or L.A., and you got a hell of a team, and I love playing with those guys on Team USA, so let's go there. I mean, that was just the perfect storm, and we're going to see a team that when it's all said and done, 10 years from now, we're going to pine for the dynasty that was the Warriors. Well, right now, we kind of lament it because that's kind of the way sports goes.
All right. Before I let you go, I just got about a minute or so left. I know there's a natural rivalry between Memphis and Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
But has Preds fever spread to, you know, to the west coast of Tennessee at all? Are you guys talking about it at all over there? Because it's all the rage, obviously, throughout Middle Tennessee and even down into Alabama.
Yeah, we are, actually. And I think, you know, there is that little rivalry, and it's funny because to me it seems so silly. But there is that little rivalry. But, yeah, it has spread, and everybody's kind of pulling for them, kind of all in it together. The two teams both play on Fox Sports Southeast. And so they did a cross promotion, and I was at Game 6 when they eliminated the Blues. It was an incredible environment, and everybody's kind of on board. And, you know, I think in the end what people are starting to realize is even though there's a rivalry and there's a little, you know, bitterness between the two cities, we're still all Tennessee. So if the Titans were to win a Super Bowl or the Grizzlies win an NBA championship or the Predators win a Stanley Cup, it still belongs in the state of Tennessee, and that's good for the state overall.
Yeah, I think so as well. And by the way, they got it right. Memphis was the right, you know, when they actually built the arena in Nashville, there was thoughts that they were going to be getting a basketball team, maybe even the Grizzlies. And the basketball team is in the right city, and the hockey team is in the right city in Tennessee. Hockey wouldn't have worked in Memphis, and I don't think the NBA would have worked in Nashville, to be honest with you. So I think that, you know, they got it right, which city got which team.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. All right, man. Appreciate you. Good to catch up. Eric Hazeltine. I mean, he's always good. He's a regular on the show.
Should be a friggin' investigation.
All right, man. Appreciate you.
That'd be good.
All right, thanks. I love that guy. All right. Let's get a break. We'll come back. We'll have an open line segment coming up at the top of the hour. Keith Jones will be joining us from NBC Sports, the NHL on NBC. We'll have him as well. So we still got more to go on this show for you today on this Throwback Thursday. Back with more after this, 7:30, 103.9 AM. Don't you pull that down. Some of you may not even know that. You might think that he just made that Monday Night Football thing.
Hey, do you wanna party?
But this. Was the original. The template. Welcome back. Throwback Thursday in the doghouse. It's Hank Williams Jr., of course, with his return to Monday Night Football. We felt it would be appropriate for us to drop a little. So we've had that in there throughout the show. And those of you who have been longtime listeners of the show, T-Mac, you didn't know this, but my bulldog was named Bocephus. Bo, we called him Bo. And Bo was named, now he had papers. He was a, you know, authentic, 100% purebred English bulldog. And his father's name was Sir Butch, Sir Butchus, something like that. So we named him and registered him with the Kennel Club as Sir Butch's Bocephus. We called him Bo.
I like it.
Yeah. Sir Butch's Bocephus. All right. Fab Five is next. Right here in the Tom Abraham Show. Keith Jones coming up. 730-1039. Yump. Yeah.